My guest today, Miguel Tinka Salas, is a professor of Latin American history and of Chicano studies at Pomona College. Claremont College. He is the author of Under the Shadows of the Eagles, The Border and Transformation of Sonora During the Porfiriato, 1997, most recently, The Enduring Legacy, Oil Culture and Society in Venezuela, published in 2009 by Duke University. Yesterday, he returned from his native Venezuela, which appears to be the latest Latin American country targeted for regime change by Washington. Welcome once again, Miguel Tinka Salas, who takes on the world.
Good morning. Thank you very much for inviting me.
It's great to have you back. You know, earlier this month in Common Dreams, you published a comprehensive analysis of the situation in Venezuela, describing who and what have been behind the ongoing street protest, a story that has been badly distorted by the U.S. media, entitled, What's Happening in Venezuela? Let's start by asking that question. What is happening in Venezuela?
What is happening is that a faction of the opposition, something very similar to what's happened in the U.S. In other words, the opposition to the government in Venezuela has a faction similar to the Tea Party in many ways, a right-wing faction, more right-wing than the traditional opposition, that has decided that they are no longer willing to wait for the electoral process to unfold. Venezuela has had a very active electoral cycle, but this year there are no elections. The last elections were in December of 2013, and the next elections would be in December of 2015 for the National Assembly, and then any efforts at recalling the president, because Venezuela has the only constitution that allows a recall, would be until 2016. So this faction of the opposition decided they were no longer willing to wait for the electoral process to unfold. And on February 12th, they launched a street action, street campaigns, that essentially destroyed the facade of a government building. They burnt buses. They destroyed the entrance to a metro station. Those actions in the U.S. would have been condemned as terrorist acts. Yet in Venezuela, they're the acts of a faction of the opposition, which the media has decided to essentially label democratic and peaceful. And in essence, we've had a series of protests that sought to destabilize the democratically elected government of Nicolás Maduro, creating conditions that would lead to ungovernability and, in the end, the ouster of a democratically elected president, much like they did in Honduras or in Paraguay. And in fact, what we have in the media is a distortion of what's happening. Protests now are relegated to primarily the Andean states, Mérida and Táchira, and some focus here and there in Maracaibo or Caracas. There is not a general strike in Venezuela. The country is not in a Ukraine-like situation, and it's not on the verge of a fratricidal war like in Syria. What we have is a right-wing opposition that no longer is willing to participate in the electoral process and has decided that they are going to create conditions of ungovernability, and they have not succeeded.
Well, you mentioned the Andean regions. Maybe you could elaborate on that.
Venezuela has a border with Colombia. Those two states, primarily Táchira and Mérida, are border near, one is on Colombia's border and one is near Colombia. Those states have had serious problems. The question of food production and food distribution is a constant problem in Venezuela. Venezuela has been a net importer of food since 1935. It continues to be that. But what happens on the border is that much of that food and a lot of the gasoline in Venezuela, which is subsidized, your listeners may recall that Venezuela pays the cheapest price for gasoline in the world, less than 8 to 9 cents a gallon. 100,000 barrels of that leaves the country every day as contraband for Colombia, and a significant part of the food production, upwards of 35%, also goes out of the country in contraband. So that leaves many places in Venezuela on the border without food production because food products are subsidized in Venezuela so that the average population can afford to buy nearly their basic necessities. So those products are also going out. So that has exacerbated problems along the border. But in Táchira, there's another set of problems. One is the presence of paramilitaries from Colombia that have been used to destabilize Venezuela. The other one is the presence of an active contraband trade and a lot of economic interests that are involved in the contraband trade that I mentioned, plus money exchange houses that also are very much making money on the remittances that many Colombians in Venezuela send back to Colombia, and also exchange houses that also are manipulating the exchange rate. So you have a fusion of various interests that have, in fact, fueled the protests there, and that remains one of the areas where There continues to be protests, even though in some areas they have also, in Táchira, begun to recede.
The U.S. media, and actually your article, had this picture of these wonderful fresh-faced students who ordinarily would attract support from progressives, let's say, in the United States, who would see them. But these are a very different kind of protest. Talk about this class differences in Venezuela and how this has impacted the situation.
Well, we're so used to seeing students as sort of the progressive element, the conscience of a country, as we saw in the 60s in France, as we saw in the 60s in Mexico, as we saw in the U.S. in the 1960s and 70s as well. And that's precisely why the face of the opposition has become students. But the social class basis of many of these students has changed. There's several layers here we have to unpack. One is that there's ever since the implementation of privatization, and here by that I'm talking about the rise of for-profit universities, the character of the student body has changed. That doesn't mean that there wasn't elite students or upper-middle-class students in universities before. There were, but these are in some ways conservative from their very inception. These are not radical students seeking social change. These are students who are seeking to unseat a democratically elected president. There's another subset of people here who are participating in the student protests, and those are disenfranchised youth, some of them 16, 17, 18, who have applied to universities, have not been able to get in, have not passed the entrance exam, and they recognize that they're not going to have the benefits of privilege that their parents had, and they're part of the student protest. But the students have been part of the movement of protest since 2006. In fact, various U.S. organizations, including the Cato Institute, a libertarian think tank in Washington, has been highlighting the role of the students since 2006. And gave the Milton Friedman Award to one of those students with $500,000 so that both U.S. NGOs, non-governmental organizations, as well as institutes like the National Institute for Democracy and others have, in fact, been funding student activities in Venezuela, and they have been part of the protests, and they have been the face of the right-wing opposition since 2006 and 2007. So it's a continuum of that process. As I suggested, this is consciously using the students as a role because it does evoke among the population outside of Venezuela the image of the 1960s and 70s.
Is there evidence of the National Endowment for Democracy and its subsets, the National Democratic Institute and National Republic Institute, at work down there?
There is evidence of that, and in terms of public funding, the money is identifiable on the record in their different websites, so that it has been several million dollars that have been spent and directed towards NGOs in Venezuela. And as you suggested at the very beginning, it's very clear that Venezuela has been targeted for regime change. It was targeted by the Bush administration. It has continually been targeted by the Obama administration, which in terms of Latin American policy has been no different than the Bush administration. And in that sense, because Venezuela was the first country in the region to actually democratically elect a left president. Venezuela has been in the leadership of a whole set of policy initiatives that extend from the Union of South American Nations, UNASUR, to the alliance of the Petrocaribe, Caribbean Petroleum Initiative, which provides oil at market rates to poor countries like Haiti, Dominican Republic, Cuba, Nicaragua, but on long-term credit, so it's not due on delivery. So they have some way to work within their economy, and they have access to energy, something that has been dramatic in changing power relationships in the Caribbean. They have been part of CELAC, the Community of Latin American and Caribbean States, so that they have dramatically helped change the face of Latin America. And we see that the change is not simply in Venezuela, but in Ecuador, Bolivia, Brazil, Argentina, Uruguay. But Venezuela has been at the core of this change, and in many ways that's why it's been targeted for regime change.
Now, interesting in terms of its relations with Latin American countries, there was an article, well, I think it was yesterday, that the representative of Panama, which of course had regime change under George Bush Sr., ceded his seat at the meeting of the Organization of American States to allow Maria Corina Machado, a leading opposition member, to actually speak in Panama's place to, as the newspaper said, to provide regional diplomats with a, quote-unquote, first-hand account of the unrest. And now she supposedly has lost her position in the government. How important is she?
Well, she has been one of the key figures in the opposition. Back on February 12th, when the protest began, two leaders, Leopoldo López and Maria Corina Machado, were the leading voices calling from the right-wing extreme element of the opposition, calling for street actions. And when they were asked how long should the street actions last, they all said until Maduro resigns. So it was clear that these weren't ordinary protests. These were protests intended to unseat by violent means a democratically elected president. And that's the difference here. Now, I would ask your listeners to think about the fact if a U.S. representative in the House of Representatives actually went to the U.N. or the OAS and spoke under the flag of a different nation, would they hold their seat in Congress, or would they be subject to all sorts of scrutiny and reprisals from fellow members in the House? And this is precisely what Maria Corina Machado did. She went to the Organization of American States, although in the Organization of American States, they had already voted 29-3 not to engage in punitive action against Venezuela. It's very interesting. The U.S. is isolated even in the Organization of American States, what used to be their own backyard, their own institution where they control the debate. But after the coup in Honduras, the countries of Latin America understand that they will not allow themselves to be used to undemocratically overthrow a president. So that in the case of the OAS, the only countries voting to do an investigation in Venezuela were U.S., Canada, and Panama. The rest of the countries either voted against or abstained. So in that sense, Corina Machado was not allowed to speak. All she could do was actually speak outside, hold the press conference under the OAS banner, but not allowed to speak in the OAS. The organization that has taken up the issue in Venezuela has, in fact, been the Union of South American Nations, UNASUR. The presidents of UNASUR and the foreign ministers of UNASUR actually held a meeting while Michelle Bachelet, the president of Chile, was being inaugurated and decided that they would send a commission to Venezuela. That commission was supposed to arrive yesterday, and they're there to mediate the crisis. And Venezuela welcomes that mediation because that mediation starts from the premise that Venezuela has a democratically elected president and that the process has to be respected. The OAS sought punitive actions and did not seek to actually recognize a democratically elected president because the U.S. to this date refuses to recognize the election as legitimate in Venezuela, even though it's been recognized by most European countries, by every Latin American country, by China and by Russia.
Well, it's interesting what democracy is in the eyes of Washington. You know, I see very much the same kind of rhetoric coming out of Washington, both from the president, from John Kerry, and from members of Congress, as we've seen in the Ukraine. All the situations are geographically far apart and very different, but the language that the government is the terrorist and not the people who are protesting, and describe the destruction that has taken place in Venezuela at the hands of the peaceful protesters.
Well, I think it's important to remember that this is not the first time that the peaceful protesters have actually taken to undemocratic means or unparliamentary means to unseat the president. There was an attempted coup in 2002 that managed to oust Chavez for 47 hours, and popular insurrection and protest and support within the military brought him back. He is the only Latin American president to have experienced the coup and actually returned with an olive branch, calling the opposition to negotiate, to discuss, which they didn't do. And the end of 2002, in December, the managers of the oil company, which was controlled by from the old regime, staged a strike, a lockout, that cost the country over $14 billion. And then they attempted to recall the president. And then engaged in efforts at undemocratic efforts again in 2004 by trying to create ungovernability. Venezuela actually has not had a democratic opposition with very few exceptions. So we see again the same policy being taken up again. There was a university burnt in the state of Táchira in San Cristóbal. The UNEFA was burnt to the ground. It's now unusable. Buses have been burnt. Clinics have been targeted and burnt. Government offices have been attacked and damaged. Guards have been killed. There's been violence with over 30 people killed And the interesting thing is that all violence should be condemned. It should be condemned if government forces are doing it, but it also should be condemned if opposition forces are engaged. And on this matter, the government has condemned violence. In fact, it has arrested its members of its own security force for human rights violations and for causing violence. But the opposition refuses to condemn the violence when it comes from their side. And I think that's part of the problem. The government estimates that over $10 billion in damage to the national infrastructure has taken place in the last month of protests. What it really underscores is that members of the opposition think that this is only their country and that their actions are justified in every imaginable way. There was even a report that they actually introduced poison into the water supply in the state of Mérida. If that is the case, that's also highly, highly condemnable because of what it does to the population. They are, in fact, blockading roads. They refuse to understand that their right to protest ends when they violate someone else's right to free movement within the country. And that underscores this notion of propriety of the country, of ownership of the country, and that they insist on that their actions are legitimate.
My guest is Miguel Tinkasalas. We're talking about situations in Venezuela from where he returned just yesterday. Today in the paper, I see the latest effort to destabilize Venezuela. They're playing the Cuban card.
They have been playing the Cuban card for some time. Let me maybe bring it to the forefront. Venezuela has an arrangement with Cuba. Venezuela, as I said earlier, under Petrocaribe, provides oil to Venezuela, to Cuba on long-term credit rates. And Cuba, in return, has sent upwards of 15,000 doctors, nurses, and health practitioners to Venezuela to help fill the void that exists in health delivery for poor sectors of society that were not being tended to by the Venezuelan medical establishment. By the way, Cuba has also sent those doctors to Brazil also, and has not caused the uproar in Brazil that it seems to cause in Venezuela, because the opposition has made it into an issue. So something that would be on the surface humanitarian, they have made into a political issue, and they claim that Venezuela is being Cubanized. They, in fact, said that Maduro was selected by the Cubans as the ruler of Venezuela and that the entire military force in Venezuela is controlled by the Cubans. They've created this boogeyman in order to try to legitimate their actions and to incite violence against the military by claiming that they're controlled by Cuban agents. So this has been an ongoing issue. In fact, 2 weeks ago, they had a protest against Cuban interference, yet they're not able to identify where that interference is taking place. Cuba receives oil from Venezuela, yes, but Venezuela also receives benefits back from Cuba, the same way that it sells oil to the Dominican Republic, and at times the Dominican Republic pays back in kind with beans or corn or other products that Venezuela would need to buy on the market anyway. But yes, they've attempted to create Cuba because it has a cachet outside of Venezuela. It has a cachet among its own members in the opposition and also will help win them support in the Congress of the U.S., where we've seen already Marco Rubio take up the cause of Venezuela or other U.S. senators of the Cuban that actually are Cuban American as well.
It's interesting how, despite the fact that I think you're right, 19 out of 19 elections, the left has won 18. All these efforts that have been made by the opposition to win have failed. And yet, if you read the American media or listen to American politicians, you think that Venezuela under Chavez and now under Maduro is a dictatorship.
Well, this is interesting because, as you point out, the left forces, the Patriotic Front, the Chavez supporters, have won 18 of 19. And the only one they lost was a constitutional change, an amendment to change the Constitution, and they only lost it by several thousand votes. But the government forces, the left forces, were willing to respect that they lost the election. The opposition refuses because they insist that the elections are rigged. It's interesting because the Venezuelan elections have been some of the most observed elections in the world. In fact, at every presidential election, you've had observers from the OAS, observers from the Union of South American Nations, observers from the Carter Center. Jimmy Carter himself said after the last election, these are the most open electoral elections that I have ever observed in the world. Therefore, they have been put to the test. And even after the last election, which Maduro won by a slim margin, 1.4%, the election council went beyond what the opposition asked and did a full recount and was able to prove that Maduro won the election. It's interesting, when in Mexico in 2006, Mr. Calderon wins the election from the right-wing PAN party by 0.26%, the U.S. said nothing about it. It was a victory. That's how democracy works. There's winners and there's losers. But yet in Venezuela, under a slim margin, a bit more, 1.4%, they claim that somehow the elections are tainted. And the press has picked up that issue in many ways, taking the lead from the State Department, since the U.S. government refuses to recognize the elections, and have attempted, usually, to put descriptions such as dictatorial, despotic, repressive, in front of any description of Venezuela, when in fact that has not been the case. And what's more interesting is that in December of 2013, Venezuela held municipal elections, which the opposition consciously turned into a referendum on Maduro. And the government forces actually won by 70%. They increased their vote over April by over 1.5 million votes. That's a significant amount. And that was an electoral defeat for the opposition, yet they won. Capriles won the mayorship of the state, the governorship of his state. Mayors in parts of Caracas won also. Capriles had won in a previous election, but mayors won parts of Caracas. So they're willing to recognize their own victories, but they're not willing to recognize when the government wins under the same electoral system.
Well, you mentioned Capriles again. What has his role been? He was a candidate defeated by Chavez and by Maduro.
He has been on the defensive because, as I pointed out earlier, the protests begin as a way to undermine his leadership. Leopoldo López and María Corina Machado, in fact, refused to recognize his leadership, and many in this right-wing extreme opposition now say that Capriles is not their leader, that he has had his chance and that he failed, that he should never have recognized the government or never have participated in the process. So he's constantly trying to reinvent himself. So he has had to radicalize his right-wing discourse in order to try to maintain relevance within the context in which the right is pulling further and further to the right. As I said previously, it's very reminiscent of the Tea Party in the U.S. It's like Romney in the primaries trying to toe the Tea Party line, and then when he comes to the national election, trying to say that he didn't really mean everything he said previously. So now Capriles finds himself in that same contradiction, and for many in the right-wing opposition, he no longer is their candidate, no longer is their leader.
What is the role of the military? What position is the military taking in this situation? And was Maduro a military man as well?
No, Maduro comes out of the social movement. He's a different generation than Chavez. He's a decade younger than Chavez. He in fact comes out of a 60s student protest. It's interesting. He was a bass player in a rock band. Much different than Chavez, who comes out of a poor poor peasant background in the llanos of Venezuela, in the plains of Venezuela. Maduro comes out of Caracas. His family is lower middle class, working class. Maduro cuts his teeth in the protest movements of the 1970s, works as a labor leader, becomes a bus driver. In fact, he likes to call himself the first Venezuelan worker president. And he points to the fact that he's not the first. Lula in Brazil was the first worker elected president. He is now the second worker elected president in Latin America. He became leader of the bus drivers union, of the metro drivers union, or a leader in that movement, and then joined the Chavez forces in the 1990s once it became a democratic process. So his background is much different. The military has changed dramatically in Venezuela. It never was, in the first place, the same as the right-wing military dictatorships of Latin America. It had a repressive role during the student movements of the 60s and the guerrilla wars of the 1960s, but it also always had a left component. Chavez is simply the most recent iteration of that left component. Much of the guerrilla movement in Venezuela came out of left military leaders that broke from the military and formed a guerrilla movement. So that's very interesting. The movement against the dictatorships were led by Hugo Trejo, a military figure in the 1950s or late 50s. So you had always a left tendency. And after the 2002 coup, many of those military leaders who would have been involved in staging coups were ousted from the military. So in that sense, the military is a different organization today. That doesn't mean that there may not be people plotting within the military. In fact, Maduro announced the arrest of three Air Force generals yesterday, accusing them of plotting to stage a coup against his government. So that there's always some tension. But overall, the military has been a different force in Venezuela. And it's interesting because the opposition claims that the military has been unleashed on the population. As a historian, I would give you a point of reference. In 1989, there were massive protests in Venezuela, the Caracazo, over the austerity measures that the government attempted to implement. At that point, the military was unleashed on the population, and the death toll was in the several thousands. In this case, there has been much more restraint. Yes, there's been violence. Yes, there's been infractions, but the number of dead remain in the double digits, in the 30 range, not in the thousands range we saw in 89. So had the military been unleashed on the population, we'd be talking about a much different situation in Venezuela. But let me underscore, any violence is reprehensible, and any deaths should be condemned, no matter who is involved.
My guest is Miguel Tinko Salas. We're talking about, as you guessed, about Venezuela. If you have any comment or short comment or question for Professor Tinko Salas, the number here is 895-2448. You did mention in your article about a retired general, Angel Vivas, who was giving instructions to his followers on how to place steel wire in city streets, which would be designed to cut off the heads of motorcyclists who are soon to be supporting the government.
Well, it's a tragedy, because when you start talking about a peaceful protest and you have, and the images are out there, I invite any of your readers to go beyond the headlines and look at the images that exist on Venezuela. I saw with my own eyes wires, steel wires strung across roads, car oil being thrown on the roads. Why? Because many of the poor who drive cheaply made Chinese motorbikes have supported the government. There's been a racialization of these individuals, but also a criminalization. They're assumed to be criminals. They're assumed to be left pro-government supporters. So that one of the tactics employed had been to string thin wire across roads at precisely the elevation that would decapitate somebody. And there has been at least four people, one person decapitated and three other killed by oil on the road or wires strung across the road. And this general, Angel Vivas, who was a retired general who had been opposed to the government, was actually tweeting instructions to put them at 1.2 meters, how to string them, how to place them, so that it would have the maximum effect to ensure that you would decapitate someone who was riding on a bike. And in one case, in the city of Mérida, a woman who was driving with her son was killed precisely by steel wire. And in my own situation, I was walking a road looking for wires, and then, in fact, they had placed a wire at about 7 inches from the ground, intending to trip people who were trying to walk. So what they did was they were blockading neighborhoods. They were trying to close off neighborhoods using fear tactics, fear-mongering, to tell the population that they were defending them, when in fact what they were trying to do was simply to prevent people going to work and create conditions that would lead people to protest against the government. And what they did was they isolated themselves. They isolated themselves. Most of the barricades were behind middle and upper middle class neighborhoods, poor neighborhoods, leading one Colombian commentator to say that Venezuela is a rather strange country. It's the one place where the poor celebrate and the rich protest. So that in that sense, the opposition's tactic backfired. They isolated themselves, and the poor in Venezuela and the working sector and the informal sector did not join in their protest. And I think that's what frustrates them the most.
It does. Well, we have a call here. Hello, you're on the air.
Yeah, listen, this is an absolutely wonderful and informative show. I wonder if your guests would have any comments about The United States has had an ongoing effort at destabilizing governments around the world, and they aimed heavily at South and Central America. I wonder if your guests would give any comments about what particular United States involvement we might have now that we haven't been told about, along with so many other things. And I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you for the great show.
Thank you.
Well, I think the fundamental is to try to create and isolate Venezuela. I go back to what Condoleezza Rice said at one time when she was Secretary of State. We must inoculate Latin America from Venezuela, as if Venezuela has some sort of disease that had to be inoculated. And the Obama administration pursued a very similar policy. They have refused to recognize the result of elections. They continuously condemn the Venezuelan government, accusing it of all sorts of violations, and using this notion of human rights violations. I think I would underscore the fact that in fact, if this government had engaged in human rights violations, there would have been dramatic protests in Venezuela, where there exists open communication, where there exists open means of expression, where there exists a very active opposition free press, and all the social media is available to the opposition to inform each other. And in fact, they use also all of it. But the key thing is that the U.S. has attempted to support the opposition by refusing to recognize Venezuela, by trying to isolate it. And in fact, what has happened is that the U.S. has become isolated. When you think about the historic fact that the U.S. in the Organization of American States had only two supporters, Canada and Panama, it really underscores the extent to which the U.S. is isolated. And this is the result of the kind of democratic political change that has happened throughout the region. The U.S. cannot count on even one of its more faithful supporters, in this case, Mexico. It no longer has the support of Brazil. It's lost the support of many of the countries of the region. And it's really a tragedy. But at the same time, it underscores the fact that there is a different course in Latin America. I'm not trying to underscore that there are not problems. Venezuela faces real serious problems. Economic problems, inflation, food shortages, and crime, but they're not going to be resolved by an opposition that opts simply to destabilize and to worsen the conditions. What Venezuela needs is a democratic opposition that is willing to engage in conversation and that is willing to challenge the government to improve conditions, but they won't be able to do that if all their actions are aimed at destabilization.
What accounts for the reports, at least the reports of the level of crime in like cities like Caracas? What accounts for it? Is it a disparity in incomes? What is
Venezuela has historically had a problem with crime. I've written a recent book on this, not on this subject, but on Venezuelan history, and it's tragic to go back to the 1960s and see the fact of how crime has evolved in Venezuela. Even in 1964, there was an effort to drop the age at which an individual could be tried as an adult to 16 from 18 because of crime. But in the last years, there's been a dramatic effort to drop and reduce poverty, but inequality has not been reduced. Inequality continues to be a very evident factor in the fact that if you travel to Caracas, you have very wealthy areas and very poor neighborhoods ringing the city in very similar fashion to what you have in Rio, where you also have high crime. It's a tragedy in Venezuela. Also, the other factor is that Venezuela is one of the countries that has a high possession of weapons. And we see the example of what that does in the U.S. But in the case of Venezuela, we have high ownership of weapons. We have the question of inequality still part of a factor. We have an ineffective judiciary, and we've had efforts now at creating a national police force because Venezuela has had a hodgepodge of police forces that went from municipal, state, federal, and now there's an effort to create a national police force that will be able to respond. And there was, before these efforts of destabilization, some evidence of reduction in violence. And they were actually beginning to implement what they called intelligent or smart patrols, in which they would be centering patrols in every neighborhood, and people could call those numbers and receive support immediately or within short time. But those efforts have now been postponed in many places because of the efforts at trying to control these violent protests. But hopefully they will be addressed again. But as I said, a question of violence is something that the government alone can't resolve. It involves the opposition. They have to take part in a conversation about that.
Miguel.
And yes, sir.
Yeah, actually, we're doing a special live broadcast after this, so I have to go off the air now with a call coming in. I want to thank you so much for spending your time with us and filling us in on what's going on in Venezuela, which you're not going to hear any other place in the United States, I'm sure. So thanks so much for being our guest. I look forward to speaking with you again.
Thank you much. Bye-bye.
Take care. Bye-bye.